Well, thank you all very much for inviting me to speak here. I really am excited about addressing you and hearing your questions. You know, we at HSUS read a lot of the ag industry press, and sometimes it looks very unfamiliar to us in terms of what we think of ourselves and the sort of stuff that we do at the organization. So I wanted to cover some ground tonight and talk to you a little bit about HSUS and some of the activities that we engage in, and really to thank you for inviting me and to invite you to contact me or Aaron or my colleagues in the future, because we really do want more dialogue on these issues. I grew up, just like I'm sure most of you, with a great love of animals, and I knew animals were different than myself and other people, but I saw in them the same spark of life that we all have as individuals. And I felt from a very young age, before I read anything about animal protection philosophy, that animals had the same kind of interest in avoiding suffering that we do. And those very simple principles have guided my work in this field since I began. I never imagined working for animal protection as a career. It was an interest of mine as a young person, and one thing led to another, and here I am working for the Humane Society of the United States. Just a little bit about HSUS. We were founded in 1954, and that was sometime after the origins of the humane movement. The first animal protection group was founded in this country in 1866, so just after the Civil War, after Americans dealt with the big issue of slavery, some folks began to organize their interest in protecting animals from cruelty and abuse. And at that time, it dealt with the horse, because this was before the internal combustion engine was developed, and many humane organizations were built around protection of that animal. Over time, as dogs and cats became more a part of the American culture and pet keeping emerged, you saw local humane societies devote attention to dogs and cats. And by the turn of the century, around 1900, there were dozens of organizations in communities across the country that were devoted to the principle of caring for animals and fighting cruelty. And later on, HSUS was formed after a down period in animal advocacy during World War I and World War II. There was a resurgence of interest in animal protection in the 1950s. And there were some folks who felt that there needed to be a group in Washington, D.C. to represent national concerns with respect to animal protection, that local organizations, local humane societies and SPCAs, whether they were private charities or public institutions like animal care and control agencies, were immersed with the problems in their communities. They were dealing with stray dogs and cats, spaying and neutering, and animal homelessness in general, and they didn't have the resources or the reach to address the big issues that were being discussed among some with respect to animal protection, issues like dog fighting, dog dealing, the use of animals in testing, humane slaughter. So really, the founders of HSUS deliberately placed the organization in Washington, D.C. In 1954 to be a complement to the local organizations that were working on issues in their communities, that there needed to be a group that could address those big questions of the use of animals and to curb what the founders of HSUS viewed as the worst excesses of cruelty that were occurring in society. And that really remains the organizing principle of the work of HSUS today. We work on the wide range of animal issues, everything from dog fighting and cockfighting to the use of animals in other forms of entertainment, to wildlife issues, whether it's hunting or trapping or habitat destruction, to the use of animals in research, education, and testing, the use of animals in agriculture. And really, our guiding principle, again, is to curb what we view as the worst excesses of people when it comes to animals, because we really do believe that people have a kind heart. Almost all people have a kind heart, but there is an asymmetry in power between people and animals. And I've often said that I really do believe that animals are a basic test of our character. We can do anything we want to animals because of this disparity in power. And really, we believe not so much in the principle of animal rights, but in the principle of human responsibility, that with our power, with our unique intelligence as a species, comes a responsibility to care for the less powerful among us. And it's that principle that animates the work of HSUS in all of these different domains. And we obviously look to all of the industries that use animals, and we want them to do better when it comes to how they care for and treat animals. And given the vast numbers of animals raised for food in the United States, that inevitably draws our attention. With 10 billion animals raised for food in this country every year, we are interested in the three big arenas of the use of animals in agriculture: the use of animals in production, where they spend the bulk of their lives on farms, in transportation, and in slaughter. And it's in all of those domains that we work in the agriculture sector. Now, I will say that HSUS works in four big areas. We work in public policy. We try to pass laws to reflect the moral sensibilities that we espouse at HSUS. We believe that there should be standards and there should be rules. And we're really grounded on the principle that our society has already accepted the basic tenet that the interests of animals do matter and that human beings do have responsibilities, because in every state we have anti-cruelty statutes that codify the basic notion that it is wrong, morally wrong, and it is a legal wrong to exhibit gratuitous or needless cruelty to animals. So this principle is embedded in the law, and it's widely accepted as a universal principle. I think a lot of what HSUS does is attempt to logically apply anti-cruelty principles in the broader range of arenas in which animals are used in society. A second arena is corporate policy. We live in a capitalist economy, and corporations have a big say-so in how animals are treated, whether it's animal testing or agriculture or so many other domains. And we work with corporations to try, again, to do better when it comes to animals. A third big arena is education, that a lot of people simply don't know the varieties of abuses. A lot of people had no idea when Michael Vick came to the public's attention for his dogfighting activities in 2007 that dogfighting was such a widespread activity, with perhaps 100,000 people in this country engaging in dogfighting activities. And if you look at all of the issues that we work on at HSUS, there is often a big disconnect between what the public knows and what is going on. And we try to shine a spotlight on what's going on to allow people of conscience to do the right thing in these arenas. And fourth, again, public policy, corporate policy, education awareness, and fourth is direct care of animals. And I know I read a good number of publications in different industry sectors. A lot of our critics have platforms in these publications and on the radio and on television, and often hear that HSUS doesn't care for animals, and I'm always mystified by this comment because in 2008 we directly provided care and services to 67,000 animals directly, and that's at our animal care centers across the country, or it's through our emergency services responses where we respond to natural disasters like forest fires or floods or hurricanes or tornadoes, but also human-created crises for animals, whether it's a hoarding case or a dogfighting case or a cockfighting case or a puppy mill gone awry or any other number of circumstances that come to the attention of the organization. We also have veterinarians who go into rural areas and vaccinate animals and sterilize animals and give services to people and animals and the communities where there are very few vets and where many of the people don't have the resources to pay for animal care services. So I could go on and talk about the hands-on work of the organization, which is very substantial. It occupies a great deal of our attention. We invest billions of dollars in these programs. But really what HSUS has to say in the broadest sense is about the wide range of animal uses in society. We could spend all of our money chasing animals down streets or caring for animals directly, and we would always be addressing the symptoms of the problem. The founders of HSUS wanted us to deal with industry, they wanted us to deal with government, and attempt to eradicate some of the worst abuses of animals in society. So that's, again, why we're placed here in Washington, D.C., and that's why we fight so hard on the range of issues that you hear about from the organization. And I really do think that the work of HSUS has to be seen in its broadest cultural context. You know, we live in a society where there are great contradictions when it comes to how we treat animals. As I mentioned, we have every state in the country with an anti-cruelty statute, and it's a felony now in 46 states to cause cruelty to animals. We have all sorts of other manifestations of our love and appreciation for animals. There are tens of millions of people who are wildlife watchers. There are 165 million pets in people's homes, and the pet products industry is a $45 billion industry in this country. We have Animal Planet on television. We have a raft of magazines and books and other writings about animals. We really have, as a society, a tremendous love affair with animals. Yet at the same time, there are a wide range of uses. Some are really now considered aberrational, like organized animal fighting, animal cruelty. And then we have other uses of animals that are widely practiced in society, such as the use of animals in agriculture, where there is an increasingly robust debate about what the standard should be in terms of how the animals are treated. And I really think that's where HSUS invests important resources and time in addressing that question. And I'm sure that some of you, if you've done some work about HSUS, know that our policy with respect to the use of animals in agriculture is the three R's. It's the same policy for animal testing and research, refining techniques to minimize and eliminate pain and distress, reducing the total numbers of animals used, and where appropriate, replacing animals with alternatives. And again, in the animal testing realm, replacing the use of animals with scientifically valid testing techniques that allow us to get beyond the use of animals in testing. In the realm of animal agriculture, we spend, in terms of the three R's, 95% plus of our resources on refinement. We work to address the issues of, again, the care of animals on farm, the transport of animals to or from farms or intermediate transport points, and the issue of slaughter. And I'm sure that some of you have learned about some of the things that we've done, whether it was our investigation into the Hallmark Westland slaughter plant in Chino, California. We did the investigation in 2007 and released the results in 2008. And I just want to review a couple of the elements of this, which I know so many of you did strong reporting and broadcasting on. But this was a medium-sized slaughter plant. It was a cull cow plant, so it was specializing in spent dairy cows. And this was a plant that had had 17 third-party audits, and each of the audits had come to the conclusion that this was a highly functioning, strong operation. USDA had a regular presence, four or five inspectors there. It had just a couple of deficiencies in 2005, but again, very high marks from USDA. And in fact, the Agriculture and Marketing Service had, as recently as 2005, labeled it as the supplier of the year to the National School Lunch Program. So we had one of our undercover investigators at this plant for 6 weeks, and he painted a very different picture of the operation than we would have been led to believe was the standard based on the USDA reports, based on the owners and operators of this company, and based on the third-party audits. What we saw, as all of you know by now, was a good number of dairy cows who were downer cows, who were tormented in a variety of ways to get them to stand up and to get them moving down the line toward the chutes and into the kill box, so that the animals could be processed and then sent predominantly to the National School Lunch Program. And I think when the American public saw the footage, they were shocked. They wanted to think that the operators of this plant were being responsible, and they wanted to think that there were sufficient regulatory and industry controls to assure that these sorts of abuses were not occurring. And again, there were very few people who thought that what happened was acceptable. Very few people within the agricultural sector thought it was acceptable. Yet, unfortunately, wherever undercover investigators working for animal welfare groups have looked at slaughter plants in the last couple of years, they found really troubling stuff, whether it was the Ohio pig case with the pigs being killed by hanging by chains, whether it was agriprocessors in Iowa with the mistreatment of cattle, whether it was Quality Egg of New England in Maine with battery cage operations where the animals were not well treated, whether it was battery cage operations in California like Gemperly or Norco, where undercover investigators found terrible problems at these facilities, the mistreatment of turkeys at a processing facility in North Carolina, the severe mistreatment using blunt instruments of pigs at Hormel in Iowa, and similar operations in North Carolina and Oklahoma. So as you look at each case, you might say, okay, well, we can excuse it here or we can excuse it there in terms of an individual bad actor. But from our vantage point, when we see a very finite number of investigations resulting in consistent video and reports that show serious mistreatment, it begins in the aggregate to paint a picture that industry self-regulation and government oversight has not been satisfactory to root out the worst abuses. And I think as the public continues to hear and see evidence of these cases of abuse, it begins to paint a pretty ugly picture of what's going on. And I think it's something that the ag industry, more than any other entity, more than HSUS or any outside organization or third-party organization, should be concerned about. Because, you know, whether it's the downer cows with Hallmark, or whether it was the downer cow case in Washington State at the end of 2003, there are very detrimental short-term and long-term effects for industry by allowing this sort of circumstance to occur. If you look at the downer cow case, now we had been warning since the 1990s, before I was president of HSUS, we had been lobbying in Congress to stop the processing of downer cows for human consumption. We had been warning about it. And we looked at the data in Europe where it showed that downer cows in Europe were 48 times more likely to have BSE than ambulatory cattle. And we said, you know, this is a time bomb waiting to go off. All it's going to take is one or two cases of BSE positive animals getting into the food supply, and it's going to diminish consumer confidence in the beef supply, and it's going to have a cascade of effects that will harm the industry. And sure enough, more than 50 nations closed their markets to U.S. produced beef after the downer cow case came to light, a single case. And when Hallmark came to light, riots erupted in South Korea because they saw the footage. And of course, there were huge recalls, 143 million pounds of product. There were 8 congressional hearings. There were advances in California at the national level on the downer policy. Why wait until the crisis occurs to address the fundamental policy issues that we've been talking about for 15 years? So I think more than any entity, the folks within the agriculture sector have the greatest interest in curbing these abuses and stopping the caricaturing of groups like HSUS often wildly exaggerated claims about what we do and who we are as a way to kind of divert attention from the core issues that the American public ultimately wants examined. Forget about HSUS, or forget about the Animal Welfare Institute, or forget about PETA or the other groups out there. The American public believes in the concept of animal welfare. We do survey after survey of the American public. We are one of 12,000 organizations in this country devoted to animal welfare, and we have 10 million constituents. One of every 30 Americans is associated just with our organization. Again, this is a culture where anti-cruelty statutes exist, where we show images of animals on television, where kids read books that really speak to the qualities and emotional characteristics of animals. Our society is full of contradictions when it comes to animals, but there is a basic value that cruelty is wrong. And folks accept the idea of using animals for food, whether it's eggs or milk or meat, but they don't accept the mistreatment of animals. And to think that everything is acceptable in this day and age, when the evidence that we've seen coming from a variety of slaughter plants or confinement facilities, that really is at odds with the public's notions of what is acceptable when it comes to the treatment of animals for food. So I guess my message to you tonight, more than anything, is it's not so much about what HSUS believes, it's not so much about what any animal welfare group believes. Take the pulse of the American public and forget about folks in the agricultural sector, because the consumers are really the major group that all of us are reaching out to. It's when we're in the media and when we're talking to regular Americans, most of whom are not directly involved in agriculture. And they are the group that is ultimately going to decide these issues. And does agriculture want to continue to defend activities which regular Americans think are out of bounds and unacceptable? And I can take the issue of Prop 2 in California. You know, a lot of people assume that the public would be concerned about companion animals, they'd be concerned about wildlife, but there was some skepticism about whether the public would be concerned about the humane treatment of animals raised for food. Now, you go way back, you go to the passage of the Humane Methods of Slaughter Act in the 1950s, and you saw that I think President Eisenhower said he got more mail on that subject than any other subject during a period of his tenure as president. So even back then, the public was concerned. I never really had much doubt about whether the public would be upset about the mistreatment of farm animals, because, again, I have long believed these are universal values and that good people just don't want animals mistreated, no matter the use of the animal. So when Prop 2 was advanced, you know, there was a big campaign on the other side, and we really had a major campaign to advance the idea that animals built to move, animals with legs and wings, should have an opportunity to use them. And they shouldn't be kept in confinement systems that deny the animals the most basic opportunity to engage in behaviors that regular people would think were absolutely normal, like walking around or turning around or extending their limbs or their wings. So we had the ballot measure to address the confinement of calves raised for veal to phase out the use of gestation crates, not farrowing crates, just gestation crates for breeding pigs, and to phase out the use of battery cages for laying hens. And if you look at the spending in this campaign, it was roughly even, but we spent just a little bit more, $500,000 or $700,000 more, but we had to organize our volunteers for the signature gathering campaign, because we had to gather 800,000 signatures to put the measure on the ballot. And if you look at kind of the post-signature gathering campaign, when people really start to focus, we had even spending. So both sides made their case to the 38 million people who live in California. And as I'm sure all of you know here, California is a major agricultural state. I believe it's number one in terms of gross revenues, in terms of agricultural products. And it's 58 counties, and while you do have San Francisco and Los Angeles, which are large centers of liberal thought where a lot of the folks are removed from the day-to-day workings of agriculture, you've got lots of counties, certainly up and down the Central Valley, that are defined by their agricultural economies. And as the debate went on and both sides advanced their views, and I think, you know, both sides did what they normally do. They made the arguments, they made the best arguments, they were poll-driven arguments for the most part. And when it was all said and done, there were more votes cast for Proposition 2 than had been cast in favor of any citizen initiative in California history. And, you know, most people, if they're confused about a ballot measure, the data show that confused voters vote no. So in order to get a yes vote, you have to have a strong affirmative argument. So the fact that 63.5% of Californians voted in favor of phasing out these confinement practices, I think should be a wake-up call to agriculture to address these issues and to begin to reconcile the fact that, yes, we are raising animals for food in society, for human consumption, for protein for people, but we also have to do it in a way that's acceptable in the norms of a society that loves animals, that cares for animals, that has animals in their home, that sees animals on television, that has historical notions about the scale of agriculture where animals did have an opportunity to stand up, lie down, turn around, and extend their limbs. So I think it's an indicator. Now, one might excuse it and say it's California. I think, again, if you look at the data county by county, you see that it was a statewide win. Almost all the counties in California supported the measure, just like almost all the counties in Arizona supported a measure to ban gestation crates and veal crates, and just like most of the counties in Florida had supported a measure to phase out gestation crates. So I think that we've got lots of big issues to contend with. I would prefer to have HSUS talk directly to farmers and talk directly to industry. The problem is, you know, very few folks seem to be willing to talk. When we spoke to agriculture leaders in Colorado, we had a sane, civil discussion. We had a productive discussion. We gave, we didn't get everything we wanted, and the ag community didn't get everything it wanted. But we came together and said, hey, this is the future. Let's spend our money on rescuing animals and farming and doing the other things that we do, rather than spending millions of dollars on a ballot initiative where the outcome is likely to go in favor of protecting animals from intensive confinement systems. So we worked that out in Colorado. I think we're having more and more discussions. We have, you know, we reached out to leaders in Ohio, and we had a good meeting. I've been disappointed to see the press accounts since then, but we remain open to having a discussion about these issues. And I really do hope that we can talk more. And obviously, you all are tremendously important in having platforms that allow this discussion to continue, because the issues are not going away. You know, when you have 12,000 organizations devoted to animal welfare, and you have all of these other social and cultural markers that speak to a concern, an ethical concern about the well-being of animals, I just don't think it's a fleeting concern. And you could take individual actors, you could take institutional actors out of the picture, but the general trajectory is clear. You look at the sweep of this issue in our society, it's going toward more protection, more attention to the interests of animals, more of a recognition that the animals are just not production machines, but they do have needs, they have desires, and one of the greatest desires is to avoid experiencing suffering and other forms of harm. I really do appreciate the opportunity. There are times when we as individuals and we as institutions are not going to be on the same page. But that doesn't mean that we can't work on things that we agree upon. And, you know, if we just worked with people we agree with, I don't think that that would be a very productive circumstance in our society. And, you know, I really do believe that, you know, I know there's a big concern about, you know, where does it end? If you give here, you know, are you then going to give here and here? Well, I think that the agriculture community will build public capital the more that it shows that it's reasonable. The more that it shows, yes, we will defend our right to raise animals for food, but we're going to be reasonable and deal with these other actors, whether it's the Humane Society or others, who are bringing issues to public attention as a consequence of an emerging social concern about animal welfare issues. And the more that ag groups draw a line in the sand and say, we're not going to talk about any of this, and we're going to denigrate the Humane Society when it goes out, just like happened last week when we were involved in responding to a starvation case for 200 Mustangs in Nebraska, and certain folks in the agriculture community were attempting to besmirch that activity. Or in North Carolina or Indiana, where we did raids of puppy mill operations that exposed awful cruelty to dogs, the pork producers and the Farm Bureau got in the way of legislation to address these forms of cruelty. That does not endear the American public to this sector. And because of the current alignment and the capital that's built through the years, those groups may be able to spend some capital, but it is being deducted from their accounts. It is not good for the agriculture community to defend these activities. When Rush Limbaugh, you know, did PSAs for us on dog fighting, or about our work with the faith community, to attack Rush Limbaugh when he's talking about fighting dog fighting and the corrosive activity associated with illegal gambling and narcotics traffic and violence in our communities, where in Chicago, where we see that people who are arrested for animal cruelty crimes, 71% of them have felony rap sheets. You know, dog fighting is a gateway crime, and whether you agree with the Humane Society on animal agriculture issues or you vehemently disagree, we should all agree that an activity like dog fighting is a repugnant and horrible activity, and we should stand shoulder to shoulder. You know, we have some conflicts with the NRA, or we have conflicts with other organizations on hunting issues, but we'll stand four square with them against poaching and against the destruction of habitat. We've got to find areas where we can agree. So I guess that's my parting message to you all, and I really do appreciate the opportunity to speak with you tonight, and thank you for being such gracious hosts. Thank you. Okay, sure.
Wayne has agreed to field a few questions. Limit the questions to broadcast council members to start out with. And Don Atkinson, first question.
The organization, and you know, I have one of the things that I have seen time and again, and it doesn't relate just to sport hunting, but it relates to other issues, is quotes that have been kicking around, whether fabricated or real, you know, back 20 years, are constantly invoked in order to paint the HSUS in a certain way. And I remember I was at an agricultural forum many years ago. I'll eventually get to the answer, but I wanted to invoke this. I was at an Illinois agricultural forum. I think I was working at the time for the Fund for Animals before I was at HSUS, so I think it was 1990 or 1991. And somebody asked me whether we should essentially have a federal statute that protects minor breeds of livestock. And, you know, at the time, you know, I knew a little bit about the American Minor Breeds Conservancy and other organizations, but I essentially said, you know, I think that you know, these are animals that are bred, you know, for a specific economic purpose, and they go extinct from time to time, and I don't think there should be a federal, you know, statute that says you must protect every one of these breeds. And I said, you know, some of them will be one generation and out. Now, that quote, one generation out, has been used time and time again to say that I'm against all domestication of animals and all pets, when if you looked at the context in which I said, it had nothing to do with that at all. On sport hunting, I've had, you know, countless opportunities to speak publicly about the issue. And the position that I've espoused time and time again is that we work to curb the worst abuses within sport hunting. And we define those as the use of steel jaw leg hole traps, the practice of baiting of bears, hound hunting with radio transmitters on the collars of the dogs to shoot, to facilitate the shooting of mountain lions and bears and bobcats, contest shoots for prairie dogs and coyotes where the carcasses aren't even consumed, pigeon shoots where the animals are treated like live targets. So I have said we're not against sport hunting. We would, if we had our ideal world, would we rather have people go out with a camera and a walking stick? Yes, I'm sure that we would. But deer hunting and duck hunting and other sport hunting activities are part of mainstream America, and we accept that, but we want to curb the worst abuses. So that's our position, and that's reflected in our policy statement.
Ron Hayes. Thanks for being with us this evening. Yeah. Certainly, sir. You alluded several times about the plural pronoun of we as far as your policy position. How do you develop your policy? In other words, how do you come to these positions that you say you're advocating on behalf of the 10 million constituents?
Yeah. Well, we have a volunteer board of directors. We have 27 members of our board of directors, and they're selected by the membership, and it's the board of directors that sets policies. I will say that as a general matter, I can't really think of too many policies where we've deviated through the decades. If you look at HSUS policies back to the 50s through the 60s, 70s, 80s, there has been a little bit of tweaking here and there, but the fundamental tenor of the policies has remained pretty consistent.
Do you ever use science-based type information to help form those policies?
I wouldn't say on the policies. I say more on the campaigns. You know, if we're doing when we did Prop 2, we have a polling firm or a couple of polling firms that we work with. We do focus groups to measure public attitude. So I think that, you know, like any kind of sophisticated political operation, you use the best research tools in order to, you know, drive your message. But in terms of our policy formulations, I can't think of a time that we've done research.
Ken Rootin and Jeff Nally.
Good afternoon, good evening. I'm from WHO Radio in Des Moines, Iowa.
Yes, sir.
I'm going to ask you why you targeted horse slaughter in this country. Humane Society of the United States has been credited with pretty much shutting down horse slaughter. You don't credit it and say it's inhumane.
Well, we again, you know, the humane movement kind of had its start with concern for the horse, and of all of the animals in the American historical experience, there's no animal that's probably had a more profound impact in shaping American culture than the horse. We don't eat horses in America; they're not raised for food, and we have been concerned about how animals are treated. In transport and slaughter, mainly transport, there were a limited number of horse slaughter plants in the country, and horses were going a long distance in many of the cases to get to these slaughter plants. They were often confined in trucks that were designed for cattle and that don't allow the horses sufficient space to adequately stand up. There have been a good bit of evidence that we gathered from investigations of horse slaughter plants to validate our concern that the horses were being inhumanely treated. And we also have been concerned about how horses are procured, sometimes stolen, obtained in other ways that we found disreputable. And I guess there's a basic principle, and it relates to our philosophy about dogs and cats. We do have a homeless dog and cat problem in this country. We do have a situation where, regrettably, millions of dogs and cats are euthanized in shelters, public and private shelters across the country. But it's done with remorse and regret. We don't set up slaughter plants for dogs and cats and ship them to other nations for consumption. And we really believe that it's a matter of personal responsibility. We think that people who obtain horses, just like when they obtain dogs or cats, should provide lifetime care for the animals. We think that should be the standard.
Jeff Nally.
Stelly. I'm Jeff Yannick from the Cromwell Ag Ritmo Network. We work in Illinois, Indiana, and Kentucky. I listen to the passion that you speak and honestly believe that you care about what you say. It's more than just your speech, it's what you say. But I also represent and work with farmers who equally say the same thing about their livestock, the husband, the wife, the child, spend as much time at the barn as sometimes they do their own home. And I wonder why the two sides can't agree. I'll leave that to the side, but I'll ask this. On your website, why such an emphasis on religion, especially to introduce your own green Bible? And especially from the creation and the emphasis in Prop 2 of anthropomorphism, that the hog and the man are the same within the characters that you use. Why so much emphasis on religion? And are animals the same in creation as the Father? And how do you define have dominion?
Well, let me say that my predecessors as CEOs of the Humane Society of the United States were all clergymen before I was elected president in 2004. So from 1970 to 2004, all of the CEOs of the HSUS came from religious backgrounds. And it's always been a part of our work, and I think that it speaks to the issue of caring for God's creation. I think, again, it does not at all relate to equating humans and animals. It relates to this solemn responsibility. If these are God's creatures, and we accept that they are, then we do wrong by God by mistreating them. And that is a powerful part of who we are as an organization, and we really believe in the distinct qualities of people. And again, it's precisely because of our special gifts that we have a responsibility to other creatures. But back to your original comment about farmers and animal advocates, I don't deny for one moment the intensity, the feeling of farmers when they're presented with arguments like those that I've advanced, or the intensity of their feelings for their animals and their belief in husbandry and the like. We don't say that, you know, the people who are engaged in dogfighting, if they don't know it's illegal, they should, and they should pay a price for engaging it. That's aberrational activity. It's outside the bounds of social norms. Farmers are operating within social norms, except if they do things like at Hallmark or if they engage in other manifestations of cruelty. But confinement systems and transportation systems and slaughter procedures are normative activities. That's just been the way that industry has gone. And we've tried not to personalize this against individual farmers. We've tried to say we're concerned about the systems. We're concerned about the trajectory of these systems where the animals are treated like meat, milk, and egg-producing machines, and they're denied the basic opportunity to live a decent life.
But you see, I grew up on a family farm in Kentucky.
Make it quick.
Free-range hogs, quick. And you had to protect the alpha sow from the others to keep her from killing the other two. And you had to protect the pigs in the free-range environment. And I see them on the inside, and by the hog, I'd rather be inside.
Yeah. Well, I know that that's the view of a lot of advocates of agriculture. I just don't think that the public buys it. You know, I think that there are lots of hog farmers who use extensive systems and they use good husbandry techniques to minimize aggression between the hogs. The animals should have a basic opportunity to stand up, turn around, lie down. That's a basic tenet, and that's where we disagree, and that's where the rub is on the fight.
Christian Bray Terry.
Mr. McCauley, today there's been a lot of news about swine flu. I had the opportunity to visit the Our News section of the HSUS website where there is a piece that implies
Yeah, I don't think there's anything inaccurate about what we've written. We said that the swine flu seems to have originated in a southeastern state in Mexico, that's an area with major hog farms. That's really all we said in terms of any link, because nothing's been established at this point. Yeah, no, but I do want to, and just continuing on from there, we have our director of animal agriculture and public health has written one of the definitive scientific books about zoonotic diseases, about diseases that pass from animals to people. And 75% of diseases that afflict people started in animals. And there is an argument that's advanced in his book that intensive confinement systems, where the animals are crowded and where you can have many mutations of the virus, can result in a more virulent strain of the virus and a flu virus that might have been, you know, relatively innocuous can become more virulent in these settings. So that's the theory. It's been validated by a lot of scientists. His book has, I think, 4,000 footnotes, and there is a fuller exposition of his views on the website. So I think that what we did is articulate that. Now, it's not just agriculture. We've been concerned about live animal markets, confinement of civet cats, and the capture of wild animals in these live animal markets in China is thought to have started the SARS problem a few years ago. And we know that there are many diseases that pass from animals to people, and I think it's a general principle that we're talking about.
I'm going to take two more questions, Chuck Zimmerman and Don Wick, and make them quick, gentlemen.
All right. Chuck Zimmerman, AgWire.com. Actually, because we are social media proponents, I'm going to actually take a question that I want to pose from one of our followers who knew that you would be speaking here tonight. Basically, this is from a farm family in Tennessee. He says, the farm wife saying, she has a lot of questions. I'll just pose one, and I'll just read it here. I have so many questions for Mr. Fuseli and other animal rights activists. My first question would be how he plans to help those families he is so strongly trying to put out of business, or are we to try to find a new way of life, a new home, a new lifestyle? We've heard it before, but farming isn't just a job, it's a passion. We certainly don't do it because we're getting rich. We do it because we love the land, the animals, and the work. The attack on animal agriculture is really an attack on the entire ag industry, as we are interdependent on one another.
You know, I think that farmers, probably more than any other group, realize that the world is not static. You know, farmers are adjusting to different patterns of weather. They're dealing with downturns in the economy. They deal with the globalization of the economy. They deal with the injection of ethanol into the kind of economics of agriculture. So our nation has never been a static nation. And the idea that we're just going to kind of suspend our concern about animal welfare as we have an emerging ethos is just not realistic. And, you know, we all eat food. And we all, as a nation of 300 million plus, have basic caloric needs. Agriculture is going to produce the food because farmers are outstanding Americans and they know how to do their job. But we're really talking about how it's done. And that's part of the tug and the pull in a democratic society, is that we debate and we grapple with each other on environment, on tax issues, on animal welfare. And there's an assumption behind the question that it's not legitimate to discuss or bring up animal welfare. And I would say that I understand the impulse, because there's almost a moral, certainty sort of issue or moral superiority issue. That people are like, okay, these people think they're morally superior to me. They're telling me how to do this. I've grown up on a farm. And I get that, and I understand that. People criticize us, and I have our members criticizing us all the time. That just comes with the territory, and I think that's part of the fabric of the American culture, is to have this debate. We don't live in a static moment, and the world is changing. It's changing with respect to our norms and standards about how animals should be treated, and farmers can't exempt themselves from that process, just like we can't exempt ourselves from things that affect us.
Don Wick.
Don Wick, Red River Farm Network. In recent years, the Park Trade Group, National Park Producer Council, has passed a We Care initiative that focuses on ethical principles for responsible animal care. Is there any recognition from HSUS that that's a reasonable move? in that direction and trying to address some of these issues?
Well, I would say that we certainly applaud any sincere efforts to elevate animal welfare standards. And typically, you know, that might mean, you know, more space for animals or more humane transport standards or whatever it may be. So we support that. I guess, you know, we don't think that just because you do something, that means that you've come up with the perfect set of standards. I think it's a process. And you know, for us, what we want to do is have more discussion with folks in industry, because now I think what's going to happen is the retail sector, more than the policymakers, is going to drive the process here. Because, the Walmarts and the Costcos and the Safeways and the Burger Kings and the McDonald's, they make corrections in terms of their purchasing practices, and that's going to have enormous implications for farmers. And it seems to me that that's precisely where we should be getting together and trying to hammer out some of these standards. I really do believe that the confinement systems have been the biggest issue that we've addressed, the issues in Prop 2. And I think that, you know, with Smithfield making a decision to phase those out, with other major producers in the other sectors, I mean, veal, we were told a long time ago that, you know, veal producers could never shift to more extensive systems. And now by 2017, the American Veal Association says it's going to complete the process. So I think that that the voluntary standards are good, and that would be the most desirable outcome. We're just going to haggle over some of the specifics.
Wayne, moderator's privilege. Count back from November 2010.
Yes.
At what point will you have to decide whether to fish or cut bait with launching a ballot initiative in Ohio?
Yeah. Well, you know, the...
you don't mind.
Yeah.
We are broadcasters.
Sure. I would say first that let's be clear that we're interested in addressing this issue across the country. We're not interested in picking on one state or another. That's just part of the process. You know, the states are the laboratories of democracy, and that's the way it works, is you've got to kind of establish your arguments at the state level. So Ohio is one of the states that we're looking at. I would say that we really hope to work with the agricultural sector to reach an accommodation. Each state has its own definite timeline of signatures, and I can't remember when Ohio's clock starts ticking in a way where we must act, but we'll do it when we have to, and I think that's the principle in the other states as well.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's thank Wayne for joining us this evening.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.